Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Call Me By Your Name author Andre Aciman to learn more about its sequel, Find Me.
Then we'll be discussing the history of one of the world's great jewellery dynasties with one of its scions, Francesca Cartier-Bresquel.
And we'll be taking a tour around a bewitching new exhibition at London's David Zwirner Gallery with the artist Joachim Nordstrom.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news, and we'll enjoy some fine music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Here we are again, Org. In the introduction there to the Monocle Weekly, I said some fine music too. I don't want you to think that. I don't mean fine as in fine.
No.
That's fine.
No,
like
no.
An ironic fine. I mean fine as in fine fare, fine food, fine wine, great.
You don't mean it in the kind of hip-hop
wonderful
sense.
No.
I know.
No, neither do I mean it in the meaning of shade.
Okay.
I don't mean it like that. I mean fine.
I assure you that this week the music is going to be very fine because
yeah.
I handpicked it to complement, like a fine wine,
yeah.
It's not your dinner of pumpkin and pork, but rather to complement an interview that I did earlier this week with the artist Joachim Nordstrom, who's a lovely chap, as our listeners will soon find out. But
yeah,
what have you been doing? You went to Margate, didn't you?
I've had a funny old week. As you can tell, I'm a little bit nasal this week. I haven't escaped the cold that's been going around Midori House. But what better thing to do than to go and hang out with, on Wednesday, Joseph Cook, glaciologist. So I took my time in getting to Margate. And before that, I went for a walk with Hamish Fulton, the artist. Got a wonderful show on at the Paraffin Art Space in London. So I had two really wet walks. And on Friday, I went to meet Zed Nelson, the wonderful photographer and filmmaker in Hoxton Street. That film is out. We should recommend it to our listeners, in fact. It's going to be a culture special show tomorrow on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
And the film is out now. It's called The Street by Zed Nelson.
Fantastic.
An estimable man.
Fantastic stuff. I think
anyway, so yeah, so three kind of wet and windy outdoor trips around London. What better way to get over your cold?
What do you think of the Isle of Thanet?
Not a pretty place, but I love its politics.
What a horrid thing to say. Shall we move quickly along?
Okay.
I think it's time to introduce our regular visitor for a little look ahead to next week's news. Who else could it be but Fernando Augusto Pacheco? There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando. Hello,
hello everyone.
Well, here he is. Here he is, fresh from Thanksgiving.
Exactly. Oh, I ate
Welcome
so well.
To the programme.
Mm. I think I'll be celebrating Thanksgiving every single week now.
You're a convert.
Yeah,
every single
like
week.
Like okay. That man has Christmas dinner every day.
Exactly.
Have you seen him?
If there's good food, I'm up for it.
Have you seen him? The man who has Christmas dinner every day?
Yeah, he's a famous British tabloid figure. Every year they do a story about the man who has Christmas every day. He obviously had some sort of nervous breakdown about 20 years ago.
He's not the fattest man in Britain, is he?
He's not the fattest man in Britain, but he isn't thin. And he decided that every day he wanted turkey with all the trimmings and a present, and he never takes his Christmas decorations down, and his family don't talk to him anymore.
There was a family near where I grew up in Sussex that had that, and we'd go, oh yeah, we'd park the car, go for a walk with the dog, but he's still got his decorations up.
Well, it's character, isn't it? Local characters.
Local character.
Exactly.
Indeed. Exactly.
Bread and butter. As very in line with your Thanet political leaning, isn't it?
It's quite a Thanet.
Yeah. And actually, if I may jump in, talking about Thanet politics,
yeah.
I mean, my first story, actually, it is about the country where we are. It's interesting, guys, because, you know, I talk about elections in Argentina, in Brazil or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, I live here in the UK and I'm very, very interested about the election. And on the 6th of December, which I believe is a Friday, there will be a BBC debate between Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson. I mean, even though I can't vote, but I mean, I think if I would be a UK voter, I would be a little bit frustrated. It is a bit of a weird election. And I have a question for both of you. What do you think about the UK political system, the first past the post? Because it is a funny one. I know there are some supporters of it, but then, for example, in the constituency where I live, it feels that my vote it almost doesn't count.
It's kind of it's not by the by. Yeah,
no,
I've often felt this where I've lived as well. Well, for me, I kind of feel that Britain has, I think it's kind of reached the point where it has to change, and that Britain is too much in love with its kind of idiosyncrasies, because now those idiosyncrasies have come back to bite the country in many ways. I think even up to the late 1980s and 90s, it worked kind of well, despite being kind of not necessarily fit for purpose. Now the cracks are really showing.
I think that's a really interesting point. My relationship with the first past the post system is similar to my relationship with the offside rule, which is...
Tell me more.
If you score the goal, that's fine.
I do know what it means. I was thinking about it the other day, and I was thinking that I kind of like it, not to draw out this sporting analogy, make me sound like a sports fanatic, which I'm not, but... You know, when I was watching the Cricket World Cup in the summer, it coincided with the final, the men's final at Wimbledon. Both of these games were kind of decided after hours and hours of play on really just a handful of moments. Yeah. That's what kind of decided them. And if I put myself in your shoes, Fernando, as an enthusiastic watcher of elections, think about it as a kind of...
sport.
A bit of entertainment. Yeah. Then I'm inclined to say that the first past the post system is deeply satisfying. It's great that a political party can
come down to
tens
this.
Of millions of votes but, and only get one seat. It's kind of funny. Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense what you said, Ogo, because it's true. It is quite entertaining here in the UK, because compared to my own country, Brazil, is very boring when everyone voted. After 2 hours, because we vote electronically, you have all the results. So there's no kind of excitement. Oh my God, it's 3:30. I mean, Cambridge voted Labour or Conservative. You know what I mean? Here there's a genuine kind of excitement in Brazil. Now it's like after 2 hours, cool, here are the results. Cool, done. You know, easier for the newspapers though for the next day.
I suppose so. Yes. There's not. No one's having to pull an all-nighter to get something on the front page. Yeah.
Let's move on, Faye. Where are we going next?
That's not what I like to call her.
Well, on the same day, if you're not very interested to watch the debate, maybe head to Austria. Maybe to Salzburg, perhaps.
Okay.
And the reason it is, of course, St. Nicholas Day, and Austrians are, not only Austrians, I believe the Germans also do it. They celebrate, and especially there's a group of men, they dressed as Krampus, right?
Which Krampus. Is,
yeah. Is
oh, yeah, he's an old, ancient kind of bogeyman
exactly.
of the hills, isn't he?
Evil Father Christmas.
But then I've been reading, I'm a bit confused. I mean, maybe our Austrian listeners can tell us a bit more, but apparently they're just there to scare away the dark spirits of winter, so they actually they're actually good people.
Yeah, because St. Nicholas predates sort of Christmas, doesn't he? He's the kind of, he's the sort of pre-Christian winter folklore dude.
He wasn't like all a that saint stuff. Pre-Christianity though, was he?
No, he wasn't. No, that's obviously post.
Seen some great outfits.
It's a very unusual first name.
Yeah. I've seen some great outfits in the streets of Salzburg from my research, so actually I wouldn't mind spending a weekend there together. I'm not sure.
That sounds like a jolly.
Very
like
jolly.
It.
Running with the Krampus. Why not?
Exactly, exactly. And finally, let's move on. I know the Oscar season, the Golden Globe season is coming very soon. And we'll be talking about who is winning or not. But on the 7th of December, this Saturday, is the European Film Awards in Berlin. And to be honest, I didn't know much about the awards, but it's like the Eurovision Song Contest for films. I mean, don't quote me on that. Every year they host in a different city. I mean, see, quite Eurovision-esque.
Okay.
This year they are hosting in Berlin. And then I had a look at the nominees. I have to be honest, of course, there's some newer filmmakers and everything, but it felt to me quite old-fashioned. I mean, if you saw the list 10, 20 years ago, you would see more or less the same names. The main nominations here are the latest Polanski film, An Officer and a Spy, which again, it's been a hit in France.
Yeah.
But I think with this Me Too movement, I have a feeling it might not get any nominations in the North American
ones. I feel
that
even in France
ones.
That had gone down not very well at all.
No, actually, you know, I think it's the most nominated film
oh, really?
This year's awards. Mm. And also, of course, Almodovar, latest Pain and Glory, The Favourite. And you also have a mafia epic from Italy. Not The Irishman, but you have The Traitor, which is directed by Marco Bellocchio, which I had the pleasure actually to talk to him. He came to our studio a few years ago. You know, he's still making films. It's amazing. He's a great character.
Nice. So when are the European Film Awards?
So this Saturday, this coming Saturday, and it's going to be in Berlin.
Before we bid you adieu, Fernando, would you like to tell us, because we've got from you coming up an interview with the writer of a book on which another very popular film by an Italian was based. What was it like? You met Andre Aciman.
God, that was such a pleasure because, you know, I love the book. I love the film. I've seen it 3 times. And Og, I know it's very cliche to say this, but I almost cried when I was interviewing him. He's such a gentleman. And I told him, sorry, Andre, I mean, you managed to create such sensitive characters. It's just amazing. I didn't cry in the end.
Fernando, until next week, when we hear from you again, thank you and ta-da. Stay tuned, listener, because in a moment we will be hearing that interview with Call Me By Your Name author Andre Aciman.
When Call Me By Your Name hit the screens back in 2017, it caused more than a stir. As well as introducing boys and girls to a lovely new heartthrob in the form of Timothée Chalamet, it wowed critics and received record-breaking ovations at film festivals all over the world.
The film was based on a book by Andre Aciman, a distinguished Proust scholar and also a literary sensation. Call Me By Your Name was his debut novel, written in 2007. It follows young Elio and his blossoming first love with Oliver, a visiting scholar. Now Asiman has written a sequel. He sat down with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco to explain why he wanted to pick up with Elio once more in Find Me.
Andrew Asiman, what a pleasure. Welcome to Monocle 24. Welcome back, right?
Yes, thank you very much.
My first question to you, as a big fan of both Call Me By Your Name and the new Find Me, was it always in the plans to have a sequel?
No, never. After I wrote another novel, after Call Me By Your Name, I decided that I wanted to continue with Elio and Oliver because I loved them, I loved their love. It was a beautiful moment in my life when I wrote it, but I kept starting with Elio's voice and it wasn't working. It was just the same thing as Call Me By Your Name. And I couldn't do that again, so I abandoned it. But a few years later, I decided to start with the father, which is what I did. And the father is going to go and meet someone in Rome. And who could it be but his son? And I decided at that point, the son has got to be Elio, and therefore this has to be the father. So I worked backwards. I think it works for me.
It did work, and it's almost a little bit of a teaser, you know, saying because people expected the sequel to go straight to Elio. But then, you know, there's quite a long chapter talking about the father, which is fascinating as well.
It's the same temperament. It's the same person. Each character gets their own voice. But what I wanted to do was to basically communicate the same emotions, the same desires, the same openness to other people and to whatever life throws you away, seize it, take it. And I like that about people. And I wanted my characters to do the same thing. So each one of them seizes something that happens inadvertently. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
And Andrew, I have to say, still talking about the father, I was very much surprised. Not so much in the book, but even in the film, there's this classic scene where a lot of people thought that he was kind of coming out to his son in a way. But then when you read the book, I mean, that's not quite like that, right?
No, but there was probably a moment in his past when he, as he says, I could have had something like that, but it never happened. Something always stood in the way. And who knows what that thing was, but there's definitely a moment. I mean, what kind of father would he be if he didn't understand what having an LGBT kid goes through? He must have felt something, and I wanted that. But then I was more interested in the woman that he meets in on the train, and so I took it there. But then Elio has another adventure with an older man. There's no mystery there. It is a gay relationship.
When you compare both books, do you think, you know, the first book where everything was new, there was an exciting new relationship, a lot of desire. I mean, you describe desire in such a fascinating way. But in Find Me, perhaps we're talking a little bit more about grown-up love in a way, right?
It's mature.
Mature,
yeah, there's a maturity about all the characters, including Miranda, who's young and very vibrant and energetic. But at the same time, they all have had experience in love. Whereas Elio, as a 17-year-old kid, has no experience. This is totally new to him. And so he doesn't even know how to read the signs. So he interprets bathing suits. Like, if you have a red bathing suit, you're not a good person that day. When you wear a yellow one, you're going to be more friendly. But that's all sort of accidental. When you're grown up, you're more staid, you're more cautious. You don't jump on things that fast.
Andrea, when you wrote Find Me, it was after the film, Call Me By Your Name. Were you imagining kind of Timothée Chalamet or Armie Hammer as the character?
I couldn't possibly. First of all, because I don't see things clearly when I'm writing. I don't see characters. That's why I never describe characters. I never describe cities. I never describe anything.
Names. You didn't describe Samuel's name.
Sometimes I don't even give names. In fact, I took the name from the film. But I had started the book while the film was still being edited. So I had no idea what was going to be in the film. I didn't want anything to derive from the film because then it interferes with my creativity. And I don't like, people send me fan fiction all the time. And I'm saying, I'm sorry, I don't want to read it because if I read it and I end up using it or unintentionally borrowing it, then you're going to be very upset. So I'm not reading fan fiction, but people constantly sort of spill things my way.
To be honest, I kind of understand then, because for some reason people get so attached, especially, you know, with the first, with Call Me By Your Name, they're so attached with the story because, I mean, you have great sensitivity to create such characters.
I think that what you want to do, and I'm not very imaginative, to be honest, okay? What I do have is an ability to read myself and to project what I read in myself onto another character. Mind you, I don't understand a character like Oliver, who is very self-aware, self-confident, energetic, strong, alpha male type. I don't understand people like this. I understand Elio's. So I projected on Elio all my insecurities and how I misread and constantly misread X and Y and Z and correct myself and can be making mistakes all the time. So that is how I read characters. And that's all I know how to do.
I mean, you're saying that you kind of understand Elio, I mean, the way he thinks, and even a little bit of his tastes as well, because I know you're a big fan of classical music,
yes.
You know, because he's quite an erudite person, yes. He's quite kind of an intellectual, I mean, he's a pianist.
Yes. No. And
are you?
No, that's the funny thing. I write about music a lot, and I care about music. I don't even know how to read a note, okay, so it's totally foreign, but it doesn't mean anything. People who know music say, my God, this is a brilliant idea. And it's the same thing about many things I do. I don't have much experience in life, but I do know how to transpose myself into other situations. I mean, it happens all the time.
I have to say another thing from both of your books that I felt as well. I absolutely loved it, but it kind of makes me cry. There's a melancholy there. Do you think that's the way life is? You know, that's the way love is.
I think people cry for many reasons. It's basically, you know, when you put your fingers on an organ, for example, I mean an organ that you play, the piano organ, you put your fingers on it and you keep the pedals on and you let the tune not die. And I think my sentences do that. I could be describing a tomato, but if I give you a long description of a tomato and how it tastes and how it feels to hold a tomato, and I don't stop the sentence, at some point you get emotional. Why that happens, I have no idea. But the idea is to keep raising the accent on the sentence until you feel emotional about a stupid tomato.
Yeah.
Okay? But there it is. And it's a kind of writing that I do, which is constantly to dilate the sentence to the point where it almost breaks and you still feel that it's not broken. And you feel a sense of exuberance, which becomes emotion somehow.
That's beautifully described, actually, I have to say. And Andrea, what's your relationship with the people that have done the film? I mean, now there's a sequel. I mean, I'm sure
people are
talking.
They could be talking. Nobody's talking to me.
Oh, sorry. Now that there's a sequel for your book, I mean, I meant.
Oh, yeah. No, the people in the movie have been wonderful. James Ivory has been fantastic. I've become friends with him. I like Luca Guadagnino a great, great deal. I have a lot of respect for him. And I like Peter Spears, who's the producer of the film. So we like each other. We all live in different parts of the world. We don't necessarily see each other very often. But I think they care about my work, and I care very much about their work.
Where is home for you, Andrea?
New York.
New York. It's interesting because, let's say, if I didn't know anything, you know, about your life, I would say Italy in a way.
Yeah, you know what? I would say Italy too.
What's your connection to the country?
I was an Italian citizen. My father, when we were in Egypt, bought the Italian citizenship. We had claims to it, but very, very tangential claims. And we became Italian, and then I lived in Italy for 3 years. They were not the happiest years of my life. I didn't like Italy at first. I didn't like being poor suddenly in Italy. That was very hard. But I've gotten to be very attached to Rome, especially Rome. And I go back to Rome at least twice a year now. And I love Rome and I love Italy. And you know, when you think about, I'm going to write a story about love and about good food and good wine and beautiful people and nice beaches. Where are you going to put that story? In London?
No.
Okay, exactly. You go to Italy right away. I mean, London is beautiful, but the affect of the city is totally different.
Because food is quite present in your book, even in Find Me, even when Miranda, when she starts cooking
she makes this quick lunch.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm jealous of that quick lunch. I wish our quick lunches would be like that.
Well, it's always quick lunch, and they have, there's food. There's something about the body that is a satisfied body in Italy needs to nap, if you see what I mean. You need to, basically, the body is happy in Italy. And when you feel the sun on your skin, you're almost very happy. You want to sit on something that's very hot and feel it burning your thighs, but it's a pleasant sensation. And I'm aware of all those things.
Very pleasant indeed. And also, Andrea, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people will be asking, I mean, is this the end of that universe? Will it be another one? Another trilogy, perhaps?
Somebody has asked me that question. I usually say, no, that's it.
But never know, right?
But you never know, because ideas pop in my head all the time. And I say, no, go away. But there's one that has been sitting with me, and I don't know what I want to do with it. So we'll see.
And what's your relationship? I mean, we were talking before that there is a group of fans of Call Me By Your Name, The Peaches. I mean, some people are obsessed. I mean, there's a lot of Instagram accounts, you know, with images of the film and of the book. It is an iconic book for so many people. What's your reaction with those people? Did they email you all the time?
All the time. They email. They send me pictures of their tattoos with languages from the book, with images of peaches, with images of it. I mean, you have no idea the kind of things that happen. At book signings, people come with shirts that have Elio and Oliver on them. I understand, but you know, I think the book, particularly Call Me By Your Name, and Find Me, I hope, will find its own audience eventually. What happens is that the older people feel, I wish my father had said all this to me when I was basically gay and I didn't have the courage to tell him. But the younger people say, you've defined me, you've allowed me, you've encouraged me to come out to my parents. How many people have told me that? Or they tell me, you've basically told me who I am. Or you've written to me the best portrait of the love I hope to feel when I'm older. And there's all kinds of things. And all of these are totally unintended. I never planned for any of this. This is not how I write. I write usually for me first. But I'm very happy that it has helped people. It was not my mission to help anyone.
You know, another thing that I like about Elio and Oliver's story is, for an LGBT story, it's almost the lack of tragedy. I mean, hold on, there is tragedy because you made me cry, you know, because it's not all happy. But you know, no one dies. Maybe I don't know if I can say that, spoiler alert, but there's a lack of tragedy.
Is there anybody mean in the books, either books? Nobody's ever mean in my books. Everybody's serene, nice, kind, generous, candid. These are things that I don't intend for this to happen, but that's how it turns out. And I think that one of the things I didn't want to do, there was a moment when I wanted to maybe speak about AIDS, and I said, no, we're not going to mention it openly. We're going to do it the way we've done everything else, always obliquely. Are you okay? I told you I was okay. That was fine for me. Okay, and so I didn't want there to be boors or bullish people beating them up for being gay. I didn't want the parents to hate the fact that their son is gay. I didn't want any of those things. What happens when you have two men who are in love with each other and are happy as hell to be together? That's all I wanted.
Thanks to Andre Aciman and, of course, to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And Andre's book, Find Me, is out now. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
Time for some music. Later on, we'll be hearing from artist Joachim Nordström, who drawn his collection of 1920s gramophone records to build a beautiful soundscape for his latest show. Before that, though, let's hear from another artist who uses music from the past to build a haunted, timeless picture of memory and forgetting. From his extraordinary album, An Empty Bliss Beyond This World, this is The Caretaker, with All You're Gonna Want to Do Is Get Back There. And that was All You're Going to Want to Do Is Get Back There by the wonderful The Caretaker. And this is The Weekly, and we'll be back very soon.
Today, Cartier is a continent-spanning behemoth, one of the world's great luxury brands. But it wasn't always thus.
Francesca Cartier-Bruxelles is the granddaughter of Jean-Jacques Cartier, the last of the family to actually run one of the company's shops. For the past decade, she's been compiling a highly readable history of the Cartiers, telling the dynamic story of how a dynasty grew from humble origins.
That book is The Cartiers, the untold story of the family behind the jewellery empire. And I sat down with Francesca to learn more about it. She began by telling me what inspired her to dig into her family history.
On my grandfather's 90th birthday, my grandfather was Jean-Jacques Cartier, and he was the last of the family to manage a branch of the firm. He ran the London branch until he retired in the 1970s, which was just before I was born. So I'd always grown up going to his wonderful house in the south of France where he'd retired to. I'd gone there every summer holiday, but I'd always known him as a retired grandpa figure, not as a head of a jewellery company. But on his 90th birthday, which was 10 years ago this year, actually, he asked me to go down to the cellar and to bring up a bottle of champagne to celebrate with all the family. We had four generations at his house and it was a lovely day. So I went down to the cellar and I was looking around for the champagne and looking and looking and I couldn't find it. And I thought, I can't go up empty-handed. And then I spotted a box in the corner just as I was leaving. And I thought, well, maybe it's in that. And I went over to it and it was covered in other bits and bobs, old newspapers. My grandfather didn't throw anything away, so lots of stuff everywhere. Anyway, I moved it all off the box and I saw that it was an old battered travelling trunk with really old stickers on it. You know, the old-fashioned names like Ceylon and Bombay. And at this stage, I thought the champagne probably wasn't inside, but I had to find out what was. So I very carefully opened it. The leather straps almost broke in my hands, but it was okay. And inside were hundreds of letters, which stretched back 150 years and covered, as I would find out, kind of the lives of four generations of my family and some incredible stories. You know, that the jewels were there. Obviously, there were descriptions of ropes and ropes of pearls and stories of craftsmen, emeralds so large that the craftsman was given 48 hours off work. So his hands were totally still before he set that emerald. Stories of enormous cursed diamonds. But also, it most important for me and what I really connected was, it was a real family story and a family, kind of a story of rags to riches, really. It's easy to think now that Cartier is such an enormous international firm that it was always that way, but it wasn't. My great-great-great-grandfather started off very working class with nothing. His mother was a washerwoman. So it was really built from the bottom up.
Given that your grandfather was the last Cartier to actually manage, as you say, one of the shops, the one in London, growing up, how kind of connected to the brand did you feel?
That's a really interesting question, because I didn't really feel that connected, is the truth. And the name is in my passport. I've always known it. And Grandpa used to tell the odd little fun anecdote. He didn't meet many clients because he preferred doing the artistic designing side of the job. But he, you know, he had to go and see the royal family because he was the Cartier. So he had fun stories about how he would be in Buckingham Palace and would fall asleep waiting to see the royal family and had to be woken by the Queen Mother. So they're always like growing up with fun little anecdotes. But they were just kind of disjointed little anecdotes. And I didn't really feel connected when I opened a magazine and saw the name Cartier in there. I didn't really feel that connection because the grandfather I knew was so different. He was a retired, loving grandfather.
You mentioned that it's this kind of rags to riches tale in some respects, or at least in its genesis. I wondered, you know, researching it, what was that early entrepreneurialism like? Was it much more swashbuckling? What kind of business lessons, I suppose, did you learn?
Yeah, no, it's really interesting that, because I used to actually work in finance, so I used to kind of study businesses and what makes them successful. So I was kind of looking at this from that perspective as well. So the guy who started it, Louis-Francois Cartier, back in 1847, he'd started out as a jewellery apprentice. He'd wanted to carry on at school, but his parents couldn't afford that, so they'd sent him out to earn his keep. And the life of a jewellery apprentice was really tough. I mean, there was long hours, awful pay, you were kind of slapped about a bit, boxes on the ears, they talked about. So he must have been very determined to last the course. And then when the opportunity to buy his master's workshop came up, he jumped at it, even though he didn't have the funds. So he must have had that entrepreneurial spirit. He borrowed, etc. And not only that, but the year after he'd set up, there was a kind of revolution in Paris and he had to shut down temporarily and he feared the business would close, but it didn't and he kept going. And there are very moving letters where he writes to his only son, who would then follow him into the business. And the advice he gives to his son, I think, is really interesting. He says, "Be very kind like you are to us. It's the easy way to keep friends, however lowly or great." Because the Cartiers at the beginning, they didn't have the money to buy the big diamond necklaces. They were dealing in much smaller things, things like teapots and bric-a-brac. They did have jewellery, but not on the vast scale that you maybe associate Cartier with in later years. So they thought they had to differentiate themselves by the way they dealt with their customers and also with their suppliers. And their idea was to be very kind and to build this reputation that Cartier was a place where people would like to shop. So a lady would tell their friend, "Oh, it's going there, Mr. Cartier will treat you well." And that's really the way that they started. And that's the message that passed down to to their grandsons as well, to the founder's grandsons, because it was really those three grandsons who took their the small Parisian business to an international stage later on.
You mentioned at the start, you know, finding this amazing trunk full of these kind of old names for places. Ceylon is so lovely and evocative, isn't it? And that is a part of this, you know, the pre-globalisation globetrotting when people are sort of going out to explore brave new worlds. I mean, that seems like an extraordinarily brave thing to do when the way of doing it is this kind of long journey by sea or whatever.
I think it's another way that they were very forward thinking is this idea of globalization before that was even really a concept, because it started off in Paris. And Paris in the early 20th century, when the founder's three grandsons came onto the scene, Louis, Pierre and Jacques, Paris was really the capital of the cultural world. I mean, you had like the Maharajas, the Grand Duchesses, the American heiresses. They'd all come to Paris to shop. The Cartiers didn't really need to go anywhere else. But my grandfather had told me the story of how his father and two uncles had had this dream as children. And because they'd grown up above the shop, essentially, and they'd seen their father and grandfather work so hard, they'd grown up with that same drive and that real desire to do their father proud. So they'd had a dream to transform this small Parisian business into the leading jewellery firm in the world. Mm. And they write about it in their letters. And to do this, they'd taken a map of the world. Louis had taken a pencil, the older brother, and he'd basically split the world between them because they realised they had something their father didn't have. There were three of them. They had scale, so they could divide and conquer. And Louis had taken the Paris branch, Pierre, the middle brother, New York and America. And he would be the one who would do this amazing trade later where he'd have a pearl necklace in his small showroom in New York and a bride would come in wanting it. And the bride's new husband was selling his townhouse at the same time. And both the townhouse and the pearl necklace are worth a million. So they did a swap. And that's where Cartier still is today in New York, 653 Fifth Avenue. So Pierre was a real businessman. He went to New York and he wrote back to his brothers, "We're starting French luxury in New York." And Jack, the youngest brother, he went to London, but with England went the British colonies. So it fell to him to go to India and Ceylon, and he would meet the Maharajas. But he'd also bring back these incredible gemstones, which basically would give Cartier an edge in the West. And I think that's really interesting, the way that the brothers split the world between them, but they were, someone said they were three bodies, one mind. So they had the same value, the same vision. And even though they couldn't communicate on the phone or on internet all the time, obviously, they were united in the way they thought about the business. And they would share everything from clients to gemstones. But they were each kingpin in their own. Grandpa said that was so important. They each had their own kingdom, you know, London, Paris, New York. But they shared everything as well.
You obviously can't write a book about the Cartiers without talking about jewellery. And you do have these spotlights on different pieces. I wondered what the process was, how you kind of went about choosing which pieces you would focus on.
It's true, because there are so many pieces. I love the jewellery, of course, but I particularly love the stories behind the pieces. Yeah. And that, to me, has always been the biggest exciting thing, the human story. Because also each piece of jewellery has, A, it's got the legacy of how it was created, the design that went into it, the inspiration, but also there's often imbued with so much emotion, because you don't give a jewel for no reason. You give it because you love someone or someone's died or you're making up for an argument. So I picked the pieces where I thought the stories were particularly interesting or exciting or brought the pieces to life in a different way.
Do any of them sort of stand out? Obviously, it's a bit of an impossible choice, but do any of them stand out as your favourites? I don't know if you have any of these, but are there any that you would...
Well, I'm wearing a tank watch today, and I talk about the tank watch there.
Okay.
So Louis Cartier was he was the elder brother.
Yeah.
One of the reasons they were so successful is that each of the brothers had different talents, and Louis was this kind of creative genius and almost a Steve Jobs type, you know? He was pushing the boundaries always, absolute perfectionist, tyrannical boss, impossible to work for, and yet inspired great loyalty in his team because he was so brilliant. So he came up with one of the first wristwatches for men. It was actually the Santos he first came up with. But then during the First World War, he came up with a tank watch. And the idea was that the design was inspired by the tanks in the war. The lugs, each side of the dial, were like the caterpillar treads, each side of a tank. And it was just so clever and such a clever marketing move, because watches at the time were the preserve mainly of women. They were diamond straps or silk straps. And men would wear pocket watches. So he had to change the whole attitude and mindset, and calling his new watch Le Tank. So the word for watch in French is feminine, La Montre. So calling his new design Le Tank, with a masculine pronoun, a masculine word, kind of really appealed to that masculine psyche. And sure enough, one of the first buyers was his Parisian Belle Epoque dandy friend, Bonnie de Castellane, and then it took off, really. There's an image I have in there of Rudolph Valentino. He's acting in Son of the Sheik in the 1920s, and he's an Arabian prince in the desert, and it's kind of one of the most glaring anachronisms in history that he's wearing this French tank watch in the Arabian desert. And of course, later it took off amongst women as well, and you know, people like Jackie Kennedy and later Princess Diana had one. But I kind of like the story behind it, you know, how clever it was, not in terms of just the design, but the marketing behind it, how they had to change the whole mindset.
I mean, that's also, you know, it brings up something that you've got chapters on, which you probably couldn't do a book like this without, which I've kind of think is very interesting, which is how a luxury brand reacts to not one, but two catastrophic global wars on its very doorstep. And how it survives that, how it weathers that, and how it comes out thriving. And I wondered kind of what you'd learned from that.
Totally. And the Great Depression.
And
the explosion of cultured pearls, which really, my grandfather said, hurt the company because natural pearls were 60% of their income. And suddenly when cultured pearls burst onto the market. For example, that pearl necklace exchanged for the building in New York. It was valued at $1 million in 1917 and it dropped to 150,000 in the 1950s.
Oh, dear.
Which just shows you like how that was the trade of the century for Pierre Cartier. But no, you're right. And I think it's because A, they were well diversified from the beginning. So they were one of the only French firms to have a base in New York before World War I broke out. So by the time World War I was over and Europe was really struggling and the European monarchies had lost, I think it was the King of Spain who said, we're the nouveau pauvre, you know, and all the money was coming from America. That was boom time over there. The Cartiers had that. Mm. They were already established and they'd made a bit of a name for themselves over there. So that was part of it. But also they were always adapting. So after the Depression in New York, Pierre Cartier started this $5 and $10 department because he said it's enough to get clients through the door. Even if we're not making a big margin, it means when they do make their money, they'll be back because they'll have their loyalty to us. Even if they just come and buy their stationery here or their wedding invitation or a little present for a christening, it doesn't matter. Louis in Paris didn't do that. He felt it would demean the brand to go so low. But he did come up with a lot of different innovative products and things that weren't so kind of high jewelry and semi-precious stones rather than the precious ones. There were more patents in the 1930s than any other decade under the Cartiers because they knew that in a difficult time they had to continually come out with new and new ideas. Always innovating.
That's the secret. My thanks to Francesca Cartier-Bruquel and the Cartiers. The untold story of the family behind the jewellery empire is out now. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Swedish artist Joachim Nordström's singular work draws on a naively rendered array of characters to construct striking, often beautiful and sometimes very funny scenes. Snapshots that offer some hint of familiarity, the uncanny and psychological truth.
Collages and drawings in a naive style that speaks to the work of some of the world's great outsiders, like Bill Traylor, offer an illustrative, folky glimpse into another world. Alongside those collages and drawings, Joachim's new show, The Anchor Hits the Sand, also presents an extraordinary installation, part kinetic sculpture, part drawing, part shadow puppetry. It's a hypnotic and beautiful work.
Earlier on, Org headed down to the David Zwerner Gallery to take a look at the show alongside the artists. Afterwards, they sat down for a chat, and Org started off by asking him what it feels like to look at someone looking at your art.
Today, it's more like a part of my life, but when I was younger, I was always kind of embarrassed, you know, because it was... You're in your own bubble, you know, you work in your studio by yourself. It can be in the nights or days and for a long, long time without other people around. And then you decide this is have something, so I spare it in a box or something or in a cupboard. And then you take it out, work more on it. And in the end, it will be an exhibition or a show. And in that time, you can be really embarrassed. It's the first time you can see maybe what you've done in another way. And because you are so inside this, the compositions, the colors, even the contents, so you're not so, you don't feel the other people when you work with this. You don't feel yourself sometimes. Maybe you have contact when you were young or child or something, and then suddenly it's up on the wall.
We're sitting in the dark in front of this extraordinary... It's like a kinetic picture, it's part shadow puppetry, it's a way of bringing still images to life, and it's extraordinary. Before we turn the microphone on, we were talking about how you set this piece up and how it's kind of variable depending on the space that you're in, or I suppose how you think that things are going to work. It's very hard to look at the range of symbols and images that you draw on and not project a narrative onto it. And I wondered, when you're making these things, how much of a narrative you have in your own mind, and if you have none, how you can possibly remove yourself from that kind of very human way of processing imagery and communication.
The process can be kind of abstract for me for a long, long time, but I'm absolutely a narrative person from the beginning, since I was, and it's always a fight to take this out from my life, but the process can be really abstract, that you work just with cutting for weeks, and then maybe drawing for weeks, and painting like backgrounds, and just change colors for some month. You know, it's different parts of the year I do, and in the end I put it together. Here it was by accident when I started to make this. I was working with the collage in that time, and I wanted to make some good backgrounds, I think, for that. So I was painting a lot of, I think it was Japanese paper with watercolor, different watercolors, in coated a lot of times, different. And it was wet, so I took it up and look through it, and I say, this is the best. When I hold it, it's much better than my collage when you see the sun come through. So it was by accident. And then I started to make like small, bad football goals and put paper on them. And then I have small lamps behind, and tried to, everything was hanging without movement. So I tried to do something of that. And one night when I went from the studio, I turned down the light before I was walking away, and a car came outside in a parking space, and the light hit the wall and came into my studio. It was a movement in this directly. I said, aha, I need motors and other kind of lamps. So I called a friend, and he have a lot of good friends who are making things like this for theaters. And so it was the start.
It feels like a kind of amazing intersection of sculpture, kinetic sculpture, as you say, of set design, and of course, of drawing. I've read that you refer to the figures that you use as stills. To what extent do you feel the constraints of collage and of drawing as static? Are these kind of figures in your head, do you want them to have movement?
No, not really. I like when it's no movement too, in a drawing or a photo or something. I really like it too. This was something else. I mean, it's about time, and it's more about music and things like that. It was interesting for me. But I still have my heart in really dry, stiff drawings and paintings, I think. But it was fun to do this because I'm always alone, and here I work together with two others, Sofia and Fredrik, and they've been here too. So it's a little bit other thing. It's more like playing music or something together. So it's different things, I think. And for me, the idea of this, I remember when I was a child and I got fever and things like that, and you were home, and just you didn't know if it was day or night, and you dreamt, and I woke up and look at the curtains. Here I want this feeling a little bit more, and you can't do it just with a drawing.
You mentioned there that feeling of, I suppose, isolation versus this almost like being part of a band or something, making this huge kinetic piece. I wondered about your studio time. You also said that you'll spend months painting backgrounds or doing figures. How do you order your time in the studio? What do you think about? Is it a question of building the toolkits that you need to then make pictures with or from, rather than working towards one framed picture on its own?
It's always about the process, and the process for me, it's not planned. Because if I plan too much, I think it's destroyed the feeling of art, and even the feeling of music. And the planning is more the deadlines for like shows and things like that. But in my process, I have not so much planning. Maybe you have it in the back backhead sometimes. You know, here I have some graphite drawings too in this show. And I made all these the last winter in Stockholm. A lot of other things is made in the countryside. But all the drawings is made, and I have no idea in that time to show them for anything. You know, I just draw last winter and had a good time with that. And for me, when it came now after the summer, I had a feeling that the drawings was connected to this shadow thing. So it was accident too that they connected. You know, it was not a plan. But today I like the connection with this. I didn't want any other sculptures. Sometimes I work with sculptures too. If I had this time I really want to have this installation like the big sculpture and nothing more.
I wondered, with this sound component, we have this very beautiful haunting music in the background. How does music, how do films, how does literature, how does it all find its way into your work? And I mean that in terms of your reading, your listening, your watching elsewhere. Do you assimilate these things? Are they important for you?
It's really important for me, music and poems. And it has been since I was young. And I was very bad to read when I was young. I like to read, but I was slowly, you know, like a snail. And I always had problem in school. But I really like to read. And I really like to listen to music and play music too, and write sometimes too, by my own. But this, the music here, I was looking for sound to this, the shadow play. And I got from a friend, Fredrik, a lot of old records from, I think it's between the World Wars. It's before the plastic records. And it's no electricity, you wave it up. He got this gramophone and records from her ex-wife's father when he died. And that guy got it from his father. And Fredrik don't want this. So he said, Joachim, you like music. Can you have this in your studio? And this is interesting. Of course, I took it. And then it was standing there for 2 years. And then now when I built this, of course, everything, all the sound, I want it come from that record and from that collection. I think his name was Murray. So now we have the name of this Murray collection. And then I gave it to my son, all this, and he's a music producer. So he started to work with these different records and make new sounds of them, sampling, and took away a lot of singing. So he worked just with this collection the whole summer. And then I listened and I was really happy. I thought he forgot this job. And then he called me up, Father, I have something for you. And I came and we sat down 2 days. And I think he had 8 hours or something. Now it's down to 1 hour.
How do you personally, and through your work, kind of interact with the past? You just mentioned that amazing old gramophone that came from between the wars, an object that has a real materiality, I'm sure, like no electricity. And then we have behind this diorama, I guess, the mechanics of the machine and laid bare, and you can see what's strung up where, and it's quite rickety, you know, it's not, it's low tech.
Yeah, it's low tech, absolutely. And it's very important, that side of the work is very, it's important like this side, you know. So for me, it was very important to show the both side. Because I have a different feeling. Here is more dream, and the other is more like you see what's happened.
But yeah, so with that low-tech quality and drawing and the papers that you use look very aged, what does that kind of time, what does the past mean for you there?
I think for me the past is reality, like today and future. I think for me art is not about this time. A lot of people talk about contemporary art. And it's, for me, it's so clear that everything is done now, it's contemporary. But for me, it's very important to understand the traditions and the history. Now I'm really a subject, it's for me to go forward, you know, in my own head. And I have a lot of contact with dead people and dead artists. Of course, when I look in the books and see, and I have a lot of friends that died. I have a lot of contact with them. And I hope, my hope or wish is that art is going to give something for people who is not born yet, you know. For me, it's not about just to find people who's living now and have a communication. It's about, like the nature, you know. A tree can be old, it can be 200 years old, and you can see it today, and you like it because it's old. And then you die, next people come, and maybe it falls down, a new other small tree come. It's like that. It's not like the advertise and things, it's always just for now, you know. It's something for now, but for me, art and music is not for now. It's something else.
That was Joachim Nordström, and Joachim's new exhibition, The Anchor Hits the Sand, is on David Zwirner Gallery in London until the 19th of December. You are right here with The Monocle Weekly. Interesting times, interesting stuff. That Joachim Nordström show, I haven't seen it, but lots of people have come back. I think came back from the private view the next day and were excited and enthralled by it and charmed by it.
Indeed, our own editor, Andrew
Tuck. I think Andrew was there, wasn't he? He loved it.
He went down shortly after I'd been there.
Yeah.
And Joachim said, oh, another Monocle person was here earlier.
Oh, I met a man with a little beard.
A little beard.
A little beard.
Who was it? Who was it? It was me, listener.
And Andrew came back and said, was it you, Rob? I was like, no, I think it was... The final guest in Macellari.
It's a really good show.
An excellent name for a show, The Anchor Hits the Sand.
Yeah. I think the sort of art that we like to go and see, or that we find ourselves going to see in our line of work, isn't always necessarily stuff that you think, God, I'd really like to buy that. I'd really like that.
Sometimes. I always tend to go and look at the things that I'd like to, might stand a chance of buying a bit of.
Very
but not always.
Yeah. For me, it's all great big Richard Serra.
Oh, right,
metal,
yeah,
spheres,
slightly outside.
All that old crap. That's...
It's literally above my pay grade.
Yeah, and also just not that desirable. But in this instance, you know, I was looking around, I found myself thinking, God, that would look really nice in my sitting room.
Yeah.
And Joachim himself, a charming fellow. I recommended him.
The caretaker.
I recommended him, the caretaker, who we heard from earlier. And he said that he would listen to it, but he'd have to get someone else's help because he's never owned a computer.
I like that. Mm. Okay.
Yes, yeah, the real deal.
He's the real deal. Yeah, thanks for introducing me also to The Caretaker. That's a beautiful track. I'm looking forward to getting into the rest of his back catalogue.
Oh, it's big.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah? The catalogue?
The catalogue.
Is it a weighty catalogue?
A big back catalogue. Shall we say some goodbyes and
let's get the Monocle Weekly done. Paraphrase our great leader. That is it for edition 543 of the Monocle Weekly.
I produced it, and as ever, it was ably studio managed by Maylie Evans.
And the Monocle Weekly will, of course, be back same time, same place, probably the same personnel next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Augusta Macellari.
Thanks for tuning in.
Bye.